All right, I call this meeting to order. The House Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices will come to order. The Committee Legislative Assistant will note the roll. There is a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Lohmer approves the minutes of February 17th. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes of February 17th, 2015 are approved. Representative Scott, do you wish to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 456 and recommend that it be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention.
Representative Scott, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you. This is a bill that's known as the Innocent Owner Claimant Bill. There are 21 co-authors to this bill. The two primary objectives of House File 456 are to give innocent owners their day in court, to open the doors of the courthouse and to justice. And secondly, to standardize a process for innocent owners to attempt to get their share of seized property. This bill is also a response to a state Supreme Court decision in Lasse versus 2007 Chevy Tahoe. In that case, the court interpreted existing statutes to prohibit a spouse or a co-owner from ever filing in civil court for his or her claim that the state should return his or her jointly owned property because he or she did not know or consent to the use of the property in a crime by his or her spouse. We do have Mr. Lasse here in the audience today, and is he going to be testifying?
He will.
And he will be testifying. Some of the highlights of the bill include the innocent owner claimant may ask for a prompt post-seizure hearing. In Mr. Lasse's case, you'll hear from him that this was tied up in court for 4 years, so the vehicle sat there that entire time. The innocent owner has the burden of production or the proof of ownership, and the state must prove the innocent owner claimant's knowledge. The state will win if it proves the innocent owner claimant had actual knowledge, and we have that defined in the bill as a direct and clear awareness of information, a fact, or condition. This definition is from Black's Legal Dictionary. Secondly, they must prove constructive knowledge, which we define as knowledge that is imputed to the innocent owner claimant who is a family or household member of the offender if the offender has been adjudicated guilty through three or more times for the same or similar offense or violation in the last 10 years, or they consented to the act upon which the forfeiture is based. If the state fails to meet its burden of proof, the successful innocent owner claimant I can't read my own writing will receive the percentage of the vehicle or the property in their name. If the state fails to meet the burden of proof, the successful innocent owner claimant who is a joint owner will receive back his or her portion of the property. There is a hardship exception for the unsuccessful claimant if they needed the vehicle, if it's a vehicle to get to work or to care for children. The standard of evidence is a preponderance of evidence, 51%, for both the innocent owner and the state. And just wanted to give you a few statistics before we get started. On average, in our state, there are 4,000 vehicles seized per year, which is about 10 per day. And the average value of a forfeiture in Minnesota is about $1,400. And the total seized amount, seized property value, is about $7 million a year. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my first testifier.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. McGrath, please state your name. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. We have a question. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was just going to be my question. Do you want us to do questions as we go of each of the witnesses, or do you want us to wait until it's all done and then ask our questions at the end?
Questions as they come up, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I might, I think we allowed about an hour for the testimony for taking up of these two bills, so we'll go with, we can ask questions as we go along, but we'll try to limit it to about an hour's worth because we have a couple of other bills on the agenda as well. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, So basically what you're saying in this bill is that it has to be a felony DWI before you can forfeit the property, or before the innocent owner defense is no longer applies, because the fourth in 10 years is a felony. And you're saying if they have three priors, so the spouse could have seen the defendant get three prior DWIs and still be allowed to claim innocent owner except on the fourth. Is that correct?
Representative Scott?
I'll defer that to my testifier.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. I have some comments, but let me answer Representative Hillstrom's question first. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, this bill does not change DWI law at all. So things that are misdemeanors, things that are felonies, are not at all changed by this. What this bill does, most importantly, it defines actual knowledge. Today in Minnesota statute, in any case, that is not defined. That is a prosecutor's first test, and it is a relatively straightforward test, Representative Hillstrom. It means any direct and clear awareness of information, a fact, or a condition. That should be something that prosecutors, in circumstances like the one you describe, the hypothetical that you describe, should look to and should be able to meet.
Mr. Chair.
What the bill also does is it defines a definition of constructive knowledge, and that is taken from existing law in 169A60-63 in terms of three strikes. You have to, a household member over 10 years has to know of three adjudications.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make it really, really clear. So you're saying that I have to prove, if I'm the prosecutor, I have to prove that, one, you knew today that your spouse was going out to drink and they were going to drive that car drunk. That would be actual knowledge. Or, two, that person gets to have three prior convictions for DWI before you say that spouse knew or should have known that that person was going to drive the car drunk. Is that correct, based on the language of the bill?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, knowledge, you're in the right church, but the definition of knowledge is more generous to the prosecutor. Actual knowledge is more generous to the prosecutor than just simply knowing. It is a direct and clear awareness of information, a fact, or a condition. So it is a very generous, in my opinion, very generous definition for the prosecutor. And you are absolutely right to use the word or, because the prosecutor has to prove either actual knowledge or constructive knowledge by 51%.
I'll have further questions, Mr. Chair.
All right.
I'll wait.
Thank you. All right, Mr. McGrath, please continue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 456, and also thank you to the author and the many co-authors of the bill. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice, a public interest law firm. Every person deserves her day in court, particularly those who have never, like wives, parents, and neighbors, who have never been charged with a crime, never mind never being convicted of a crime. But under Minnesota law today, those people are not receiving their day in court. The courthouse doors are locked, and this is because of a decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2009 called Lasse versus 2007 Chevrolet Tahoe. Mr. Lasse will testify later this morning, and what he will tell you is that he won at the district court, he won at the court of appeals, but the Supreme Court said he did not know about his wife's violation of a DWI law. But what the Supreme Court said was his knowledge doesn't matter. we're going to interpret the statute to say the singular means the plural, and if Mrs. Lasse was guilty, Mr. Lasse was guilty. Well, that's a question of statutory interpretation, and that's an invitation for this committee and this legislature to clarify its laws, that if someone like Dave Lasse didn't know and won at the district court, didn't know and won at the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court admitted that he didn't know of the crime, he should get back his 2007 Chevrolet Tahoe. But to be generous to concerns about that have been expressed to us over the years on this, what this bill does is doesn't give him back his 2007 Chevrolet Tahoe. It gives him back half his 2007 Chevrolet Tahoe. We think that is fair. We think a day in court is the very thing that is meant by the concept of due process. You are due, you are owed a process. Today, there is no process. There is no process, and nothing, and people like Dave Lasse, the thousands of them in Minnesota, are not getting anything that they're due. In addition, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Scott is right that this codifies a process that puts burdens on the property owner and burdens on the government. The property owner has the burden of production to show that he or she is a co-owner. The prosecution has the burden of proof to show by 51% that the property owner knew or should have known. If successful, this bill gives back just half the vehicle to the co-owner. And more so, this bill codifies what is going on in courts today, in some courts today. It takes from federal law a incentive to cooperate with law enforcement. It says to one spouse that if your other spouse is doing something wrong, you're incented to call the police and to cooperate with police. But most importantly, it exempts poor people. Someone who needs the car to drive to daycare and to drive children to daycare and to drive to work. This is a narrow exception of dependency, and it is commonly a consideration in courts today. Finally, Mr. Chairman, members, let me just say one thing that this bill does not do. It does not change seizure law at all. The police are engaged in seizures on the streets. Prosecutors are engaged and with defense attorneys in forfeiture in court. Nothing in this bill changes seizures at all. Your sheriffs, your police officers will be able to do what they do today. If they have probable cause and they suspect a crime, they can stop the car, they can search the car. None of that is changed by this bill. This bill only changes the court procedures between prosecutors and defense attorneys. I'd be happy to answer the committee's questions, particularly Representative Hillstrom's questions.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. McGrath, your testimony was that this encourages spouses to cooperate with law enforcement to stop this from happening. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, isn't it a fact that spousal privilege is actually the defendant's privilege to waive, and so that even if you encourage the spouse to cooperate with law enforcement, that it is actually the defendant who can keep that spouse from testifying in these kinds of cases? So even if the law encourages cooperation, it is the defendant who has the spousal privilege to waive or not waive, not the person who calls.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, This section comes exactly word for word out of federal law. This does not have to do with testimony in the courtroom where Representative Hillstrom is right. What it has to do with is notification to law enforcement of a crime. So there may be a little tension with the issues of spousal privilege, but no court has objected to this part in federal law, and I don't believe that tension is anything to be nervous about.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does that spousal privilege also apply in the civil law case? Or so if the state wanted to, after the defendant is convicted, wanted to call the spouse who did the drunk driving to say, yeah, my spouse knew that I was going out to the party, does it keep the innocent owner from claiming spousal privilege and keeping the defendant's statements about what the spouse knew or didn't know at the time of the driving from coming in as evidence in the court case?
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. McGrath,
Madam Representative Hillstrom, in a civil case, let others respond to your questions who have litigated more civil cases than the handful that I have. But in this, this is a question. First of all, very few cases actually go to court, and so the hypothetical that you raise is very uncommon in Minnesota, given the large percentage of cases that are settled. But I believe the spousal privilege the spousal privilege only applies to communications between the spouse and not observations. And if you saw your spouse come home drunk after driving, that is an observation, not a spousal communication. Representative Hillstrom.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if I say to you, I'm going to the bar tonight, I will see you at 2, that's a spousal communication, is it not?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I'm happy to, I'd ask the committee to allow one of the other testifiers who litigates these cases to address this level of fine detail that Representative Hillstrom is right to ask. What I'd like to do is just elevate the discussion to the idea that the spouse today isn't even getting in court. And that is the problem of the Lasse decision.
Any other questions?
Later.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Senator Dean Barkley. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Dean Barkley. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Should I go ahead?
Yes, please do. Thank you.
Well, I was asked to testify due to my experience I recently had with the Minnesota forfeiture laws. The incident occurred last April when I found out that my son had taken my GMC Envoy without my permission or knowledge, supposedly to go get some, deliver some tires that he had sold. But that evening he went out in my car with some friends and got a DWI. Golden Valley pulled him over on the way back on 394. First thing I knew of this is I got a call from my son from jail the next morning. And obviously then I said, well, so the city can do to get him out of jail. It was on a Friday. And I asked him, well, where's my car? And he said he didn't know. And I said, well, who pulled you over? And they said, Golden Valley. So I called up the Golden Valley Police Department and asked them what car was my son driving, and it was my Envoy. And I asked, well, what do I have to do to pick up my truck? It wasn't my son's, it was mine that he had taken without permission. They said, well, bring down your proof of ownership to the my title down to the station, and we'll let you go get your car. So I did that, went down to Golden Valley Police. I was going to go pick up my car. And they said, well, we changed our mind. We're not going to give you your car. We think we're going to seize it instead. I says, well, on what basis? Well, I didn't really have an answer. So I says, well, okay. So I went back and looked at the forfeiture laws. I went online, and they're quite complicated. There's two different sets, one for one set of circumstances and one for another. So I saw a provision in there that said if I handed over my title, then I would get the car back pending the outcome of the case. So I went down there with my title. I said, here's my title. There's no security interest. Let me get my car, and then if you win your case, then you can have it. And they says, no, we're not going to do that. And I said, why? Again, no answer. And I found out this is incredible. It's the only law that I've ever been aware of that I looked at where the burden of proof, you are presumed guilty, and it's up to you to prove you're innocent. You know, I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer for 37 years, and for the life of me, I've never seen a law passed by a legislative body telling a person that you are presumed guilty and you have to prove your innocence. Well, you've got it in these forfeiture laws. You are guilty and you have to go to court and prove that you're an innocent owner, which, okay, I'd be willing to do. Well, I filed immediately. I had some buddies who were also attorneys, so I didn't have to pay. I got a pro bono work, which was a thing because the car was only worth a couple grand. We tried to get a court case, and then it kept on being postponed. And we called the clerk of the court, says, why? Well, the prosecutor doesn't want to hear it yet. And they delayed the court case for over 5 months. I finally got it resolved in August in a court trial. We finally got a court date. Took the judge about 2 seconds to rule in my favor because the prosecutor had absolutely no evidence showing that I had any knowledge of what my son was doing. And so then finally I got to get the car back. I went to the impound lot and got it, and the next thing I found out, well, there are no plates on my car. I said, well, what happened to my plates? I was never notified of any forfeiture of my plates or anything else. So I'll confess I had to drive the car illegally without plates because it's the only way I could do it to the DMV office to find out what happened to my plates. It says, well, you've got to get whiskey plates now. So I appealed that, and I've never heard back. I appealed that in late November, never heard a word back from good old motor vehicle. I guess they just want to ignore me also. So I did get, they did have to pay the impound fees, thank goodness. But I think that the whole burden issue that I have to go in and prove that I am an innocent party on this situation is ludicrous. I just can't believe that's still on the books. Is that because the prosecutor should have the same burden in any other case, civil case. They have the burden to prove that, you know, that you violated something, that you're entitled to take the property, not the reverse that you have now. I mean, they've got that ability to do that. And another thing that I'd suggest, if they bring a frivolous case, which I think they did with me, they had absolutely no evidence that I knew that my son was going to drive that car. And he didn't have a record of 3 or 4 DUIs, that they should actually have to pay costs. Number one is you have to be able to get into court. I was lucky enough to have a second car, so I didn't need it to go to work. But I've been in courtrooms where people have come in, and that's their only way they can get to work. And they're out of luck. They're SOL. They just are. They don't have the advantages that I had. And if I had to hire an attorney to do what I did, I would have paid more than the car was worth. It's just that simple. So I urge you to take a look at this. There are some good provisions in this bill that will at least switch the burden of proof as to where they had actual constructive knowledge as to where it should be the prosecutor, not the defendant. So that's a good provision in here, and I hope you consider doing that, because my experience was nothing short of as a nightmare. I couldn't believe that he had to go through the hoops he had to go through. And I do understand the forfeiture laws. There is a place for that, but this innocent victim thing is completely backwards. It's just messed up.
Excuse me, there's a question. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Barkley, and mm-hmm. I thank you for coming today, and I'm sorry that you had that experience. You made a point where you said they didn't have an answer for you, and sorry, as a police officer, I kind of have to challenge you just a little bit, because I can't hold the car unless there was a violation that meets the basis for a forfeiture. Mm-hmm. So at some point, somebody had to provide to you that your son had an aggravated offense. It was 3 and 10. It was 2 and whatever it may be, that it met for forfeiture.
Well,
status.
I was aware of the offense.
Okay.
I was saying that's not an issue. But when I brought the title, I actually brought a copy of the law that said that they're supposed to give it to me when I give them the title. I showed them that. they didn't have a response of why that didn't work. They were just silenced. They couldn't explain to me why I then couldn't get the car. I mean, I tried to be as informative as I could to tell them that I'm following the rules. What am I doing wrong?
That much, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Jones.
That much I got, but your first statement was they didn't have an answer when you went down to pick up the car when they told you that you could on
they
the
didn't.
Phone.
Senator Barker.
And so that was what I was trying to clarify, was that at least somebody provided you with, or there was an actual violation that met for the forfeiture in the first place.
Oh, so, I was aware of that, yes.
And then, Mr. Chair,
Representative,
when the plates were impounded, so as the owner, you were not provided any documentation or a 7-day or a temporary tag to do with the plate forfeiture, or any notification on that as well either?
No, the first time I knew that the plates were gone is when I went to pick it up in August. Okay. And there were no plates on the car, so then I asked, and they said, well, you have to go down to Golden Valley Police. I said, well, how am I going to do that? I don't have a car now because there's no plates. So I managed to evade the police to get the 3 miles I had to go, and then I asked them where are the plates. So that's the first time I knew that they'd been taken. No, nothing in the mail, no phone call, no anything. And I went to the DMV, which is across the parking lot from the police station in Golden Valley, and they gave me the whiskey plates that they still have on the car now.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions? All right, thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Mr. David Lassie. And we have 30 minutes left for this bill and also 415 House file. So we ask that you keep your testimony to 2 to 3 minutes, please. Please identify yourself to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Lossie. I'm the Lossie in the landmark lawsuit, Lossie versus a 2000 Chevy Tahoe. I live in Cambridge, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor for the HF 456 bill. I have nothing to gain by being here. I have already lost my $35,000 vehicle, paid thousands of dollars in legal expenses. I can't get them back. I'm here for only one reason. I do not want this to happen to another Minnesotan. Here's my history in the case. The district court ruled in my favor. It said I did not have the necessary level of knowledge. It ruled I was an innocent owner. The Court of Appeals agreed and said I was an innocent owner. But I lost at the Minnesota Supreme Court. The Supreme Court also said I did not know about the crime. But then it moved the goalpost. The court found that my not having any knowledge about the crime was not enough to get my vehicle back. Instead, the court said that because my wife Jean was guilty of crime, I was guilty of the same crime. But by this new standard, I was found not to be an innocent owner, even though I was asleep at the time the crime occurred. More importantly, no spouse in Minnesota will be considered an innocent owner when they have the same facts as me. I'm happy to discuss the facts of my wife's criminal case, my civil case, that I fought for more than 3 years. I ask that you vote for the HF 456. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Mr. Ben, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Ben Feist, please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm legislative director with the ACLU of Minnesota. We've already heard a lot of testimony here in support of the bill. I'm simply here to add that the ACLU wants to join in with the Institute for Justice, the Minnesota Criminal Defense Lawyers, and others who are supporting this important change. As many of you know, we've been working on reforming Minnesota's forfeiture laws for many years now, going back to at least 2009. This is a small change, ultimately, in the law, but an important one because it addresses due process. And for that reason, we take this very seriously and hope that the committee will pass this bill today. I'm happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Okay, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Bob Small. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Robert Small, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to speak against this bill. This bill has been reviewed by both our criminal committee and our civil committee. It has been reviewed by our board of directors, and we stand in opposition to this bill. I am advised that I only have 3 minutes, and so I'm going to be brief in my comments, but I would like to let you know that there are many, many specific reasons why we are in opposition to this very complicated bill that would dramatically change the current law, would make forfeiture so onerous to both law enforcement and to criminal prosecutors that it would result in not being able to utilize this effective tool to keep the instruments and proceeds of crime out of the hands of convicted offenders. So in that time, just to highlight some of the reasons we oppose the bill, let me start with the definitions that were mentioned earlier. These definitions include actual and constructive knowledge. These definitions are contrary to the definitions provided in well-established existing case law that has been in existence for over 100 years. Secondly, the bill changes the current law so as to allow a person to file a claim at any time. By changing the current law to be able to file a claim at any time, there would never be finality to any claimant, and there would be an unlimited amount of time in which to file a claim. Thirdly, the bill changes the current law and allows for a hearing shortly after the claim has been filed. The timing for this hearing does not provide prosecutors with sufficient time to prepare for that hearing, particularly in light of the changing burden of proof as provided in this bill. The hearing would likely occur before the completion of the criminal case and divert resources to the forfeiture case rather than to the underlying criminal case. Next, with respect to the bill's changing of the current law setting forth the burden of proof, the claimant would merely be required to demonstrate that the person is an owner, not having a burden to provide that the person is an innocent owner. The burden, once shown that the person is an owner, would shift to the state, and the state would then have the burden of proving innocence. And as a practical matter, that means that the state would have the burden of proving a negative. Next, the bill changes current law and allows for an unworkable process for joint owners and an unrealistic process to partition the property. And the bill creates a new hardship provision which exempts certain property from forfeiture. The bill also creates a new and unnecessary process for those who are identified as having an after-acquired interest. The current law currently allows consideration for the claims made by a bona fide purchaser. Lastly, also contrary to current law, the bill allows a suspect to invoke the Fifth Amendment in the civil proceeding, and this is particularly problematic given the amount of time and the timing provisions that I mentioned earlier. I would just mention, I'd like to address a lot of the what I believe are inaccuracies that you've been presented. I believe that Senator Barkley's testimony demonstrates that the courtroom doors are actually open to people who have a claim of innocent ownership, contrary to Mr. McGrath's testimony that the courtroom doors are closed and that the court process worked. My goal is to inform you that this is a very complicated bill that changes processes in a very significant way, and that with the changes in the law in the 2010 session as well as the 2014 session, I don't believe it's necessary to delve into this very, very complicated area. Having just finished teaching an evidence course, I would just mention at St. Thomas University, I would just mention that the spousal privilege, Mr. McGrath mentioned that this comes directly from the federal law. the application of a spousal privilege in federal law is different than the application of the spousal privilege in Minnesota law. Representative Hellstrom's comments were right on and highlighted the problem.
And if I could interrupt, Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Small, I want to make sure that I understand the actual language of the bill correctly. This isn't just DWI law that this is changing. This is actually changing drugs, including sale, fleeing a police officer, drive-by shooting, and prostitution offenses as well. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's my understanding from reading the exceptions for the people who are in poverty or who have child care issues or the need to transport a child, that even if they have actual knowledge, if they have actual knowledge that someone's going to go do a drive-by shooting, that if they're poor, they can get their vehicle back. Is that correct, based on the language of this bill?
Mr. Small.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, yes, that's correct.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, is it your intention that someone who has actual knowledge that someone is going to go and do a drive-by shooting, that just because they're poor, they should get the vehicle back? Because that's what your vehicle, that's what your bill says.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. I think that's something if we have a problem with the language, we can certainly work on the language. But, yeah.
Any further questions? Mr. Small, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much for hearing us out.
Is there any other testimony from the audience? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And thank you to the chair and the committee for the time to present our views to you. We do support this bill. Now, as Mr. McGrath said, Mr. Small takes an issue with this bill does allow people to get into court that are currently shut out, that have no access to court whatsoever, no process whatsoever. Just because you get into court, of course, you're not guaranteed to win, but currently, under current law, innocent co-owners cannot get into court. That's why Mr. Lossie is here right now to testify, to tell his story to the committee, because people like him cannot get into court. That's what the Minnesota Supreme Court said in the Lossie case. If you're an innocent co-owner, they said under current law, the car cannot be divided. We can't cut a car in half. And that's one of the things this bill is seeking to fix. In Mr. Lossie's case, like other people's cases, there's no doubt, because every single court that looked at it, the trial court, the Court of Appeals, and the Minnesota Supreme Court, they all said Mr. Lossie had no knowledge that his wife was going to use the vehicle illegally. So there's no dispute in his case that he was an innocent owner. But the Minnesota Supreme Court said, sorry, the current law has no remedy for you. And that's purely a question of statutory interpretation. So that's why we're asking you to fix this error in the law, because I don't think the legislature ever intended it to be that way. And currently what happens right now is, since I've litigated many of these cases, forfeiture cases for innocent owners and innocent co-owners, is if you are an innocent owner or an innocent co-owner, you're probably going to be deprived of your vehicle for months and months and months, which is exactly what happened to Senator Barkley that you just heard from. So sure, he eventually got his vehicle back. The County Attorneys Association wants you to believe that, well, that means that current law works. But anyone who's innocent, who was never charged with a crime, never convicted of a crime, but was deprived of their property for 5 months, no one is going to tell you, members of the committee, that, oh, the system worked because I was deprived of my property for 5 months. And Senator Barkley was just up here and told you, in his case, he's an attorney, and he's lucky he has some friends that are attorneys, so he was able to get the work done pro bono. But what if it was Mr. Lossie? What if Mr. Lossie actually got his car back, but he already told you he spent $8,000 in attorney's fees? So should he have to spend $8,000 in attorney's fees and be deprived of his property for 5 months? Well, then he eventually gets his property back. So does that mean that the system works? Well, it doesn't sound like it to me. the last thing I want to say is the state, in this bill, the County Attorneys Association complains that the state has the burden of proving a lack of innocence. Now, what does that mean? That means that you're actually presumed innocent, okay? If you're an innocent co-owner, you're not the offender, you're not the person charged with a crime. So you're presumed innocent under this bill. That's exactly what we all think that the law should be, that whether you're in criminal court or whether you're talking about forfeiture, you should be presumed innocent. The government should not be allowed to seize your property. Then you have to prove that you're innocent, and you have to pay money to an attorney, and maybe even if you have to win, you have to be deprived of your property for months. That doesn't seem fair to the average person on the street. You don't have to be an attorney to figure that out. So we would ask that you vote in favor of the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to Representative Scott, and you're going to want a testifier to answer it probably, and I'm not sure which, so I don't really care who does it. So I'm looking at your definitions of actual and constructive knowledge, and it says that the owner has to have been adjudicated guilty three or more times of the same or similar violation. However, you have a large number of crimes that you're actually changing the statute on. So it makes sense in the DWI statute that someone might have one conviction of a DWI prior. But when it comes to prostitution or drive-by shootings or controlled substances, do you have to have the conviction in the same category? So someone needs to be convicted of controlled substance crimes three times before you have actual knowledge that the vehicle is being used for criminal activity? Or do you have to do three drive-by shootings before you know constructively that this person's going to use the vehicle for the criminal activity? Or do you have to have three specific convictions for prostitution offenses before you know that the person driving the vehicle is using it for criminal activity? Or can you have any conviction for any of those three crimes, which should cause you to know that the person is using it for criminal activity? For example, someone might use a prostitute as well as be convicted for a controlled substance crime. Do they have to have three specific convictions under each specific provision under your bill before that vehicle is forfeited?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I answer that, Representative Hillstrom, I wanted to bring your attention. Line 8.4 in the bill regarding the previous question that you asked, and it says that the court may order the return of the vehicle. It doesn't say it shall. So it would be up to the discretion of the court in the case that you said there's a drive-by shooting, that sort of thing. It would be up to the discretion of the court whether or not to return that vehicle. And then on the second question, I guess Mr. McGrath wants to answer that.
Mr. McGrath. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, these hypotheticals do exist. You can imagine any combination of a bad guy. Absolutely. But the reality is that they are nowhere near the 4,000 vehicles, the 7,000 seizures. They do not constitute a significant portion of the 7,000 times that Minnesotans are having their property seized. The question about constructive knowledge was borrowed from existing statutes and extended to other crimes. Clearly the intent here is to focus on a person doing repeatedly when it is difficult for the prosecutor to prove actual knowledge. This is a benefit for prosecutors that your hypotheticals seem to attack.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these may be hypotheticals, but they're real-life situations in many, many instances. And so the question that I want to know is, in order for an... So here's the setup. So you're going to let somebody get into court, and you're saying that an innocent owner should get to be in court. But if you're not really innocent, an innocent owner, but you have actual knowledge of the crime, but you're poor, you still get to get the vehicle back.
Yes.
And so what I'm asking you is, how many times do I have to know that the person is going to do a drive-by shooting with my car before it's not okay for me to get the vehicle back?
Mr. Chair.
How many times do I have to know that the person is going to behave in prostitution before I'm not going to get my vehicle back? And so Words matter, and you're telling me that words matter, and innocent owners have the right to get into court. And I'm saying words matter, too. And I want to know when someone commits more than one drive-by shooting, the innocent owner knows about it, when they're not going to get their car back based on the language of the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative
Scott. First of all, if someone's convicted of a drive-by shooting, I hope that prosecution and the court system would put them away. They wouldn't be able to commit another drive-by shooting. Secondly, again, the language says the court may. To me, those are when you've got an extreme circumstance like that, I don't think any court in the world is going to say, yeah, we're going to give you your vehicle back. If the word is may, we did not put the word shall in there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just these hearings are going to take place before the conviction takes place. So you're going to have the decisions made about the innocent owner property done before the prosecution is completed, either convicting or having the person be found innocent. They're going to be done first. So words matter.
So we have 10 minutes until the next bill time expires. We have 10 minutes to hear the next bill. Representative Lesch?
Well, in light of that, Mr. Chair, I'll hold off. But I would just make the comment. We don't have time to hear from folks on this, but I'm curious about, I'd like to hear more about the background and philosophy of forfeiture laws, because it seems to me that the point of forfeiture laws was to seize objects or property that was used as the instrumentality of crime. It seems to me that in the old days, that was the gun that you used to hold up a liquor store or the gambling equipment and that you used to run an illegal gambling house. And the application of people's motor vehicles, I think, was probably later on. But I think that does matter, because the discussion around the table suggests that forfeitures is a legitimate extension of punishment, the punishment portion of our criminal justice philosophy. And I'd like to hear more about that in light of 10 minutes, not right now, Mr. Chair, but I suspect that this conversation is going to continue.
Thank you. On the last comment or question, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott. Can you maybe, or whoever, explain to me, this is kind of on the lines with Representative Hillstrom, but when inside a DUI law, I kind of get it. Now, outside of DUI law, if the person does know and you're allowing a may, this is creating a situation where I'm working a case like I used to do on a robbery suspect. And we've been following that person or whatever it may be, or maybe it was a homicide suspect. And we've seen that car, we know it was that car involved, or it was a drug case, whatever it may be. We've seen him drive that car time and time again, but that car is registered to the parents. Commonly done in the case of someone trying to be surreptitious, and they know the law, and they thought, well, hey, A, my mom's name's going to be on the car, so when you run the plate, it's going to come back to my mom, so it's not going to raise the same suspicion. Then if I get stopped in the car, at least maybe this will be where they won't be able to forfeit it now, because it'll be in my mom's name. I've had the same circumstance when they've actually done it with a buddy. They bought the car, they provided the cash, but registered it in and had a buddy go pay for it. So how does this proposed legislation combat that? Because I can stop the car full of documents. I could have all the mail. I could, and people, if you go out to my car right now, I've got kids, and it's a mess. And there's probably letters laying on the back floor. Representative Zerwas will attest to that. So there's documents or different things in there from various months, even probably, in the back of my seat that would say it's to Dan Schoen at my address. So we also use that currently when it comes to the vehicle to provide, say, such as we'd call them residency documents, but just to provide ownership or control. And so this is a big concern. And what I'm seeing is, if we don't like vehicle forfeitures, then let's do the bill that says we're not going to forfeit vehicles at all. But can you explain to me how this bill works within that? Because I'm still concerned with the May language on that. I mean, when, like Representative Hillstrom pointed out, in theory, I mean, if mom knows you're going to do a drive-by shooting, but you're poor and you can get your car back, that shouldn't be a May. Shouldn't even be allowed. So that's really problematic to me.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoen, the bill sets up a test that is long recognized in law. It is a two-prong test. It is one of actual knowledge and constructive knowledge. And it defines actual knowledge. And so if the suspect is going to be prosecuted criminally, the suspect is going to go to jail. And the only question that this legislation deals with is what do you do in the case when there is a instrument of a crime? And the bill sets up a mechanism for the determination, and it standardizes the determination of what you do. And so law enforcement, the prosecutor, everything that you do on the street is unchanged. The prosecutor must show that there was direct and clear awareness of information, a fact, or a condition, and so it would be the burden by 51% of the prosecutor to show that parent doesn't deserve to get the car back, that parent is innocent, and a hurdle of 51% is not particularly difficult. And it is consistent with the idea that a person not only deserves her day in court, but deserves a presumption, a parent deserves a presumption of innocence, and that the government should prove guilt.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McGrath.
Well, one more thing, Mr. Chair. When you say it doesn't change...
Representative Schoen, I'm sorry. We need to move on.
Well, I'm going to make this one statement real quick, and then I'll be done.
Briefly, please.
When you say that it doesn't change what we do on the street, that's not actually true, because that whenever there's a change in burden, that changes what we have to do on the street. So that is actually true. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't, but I think when you're trying to clump this together, the DUI thing, I think most of society can understand, because we already have different levels of where forfeiture would be for repetitive crime. But when you're moving into areas that also are talking, again, I know we keep coming back to drive-by shooting, this is a little tough to swallow right now.
Mr. Chair, and I would just say I'd be happy to work with the folks that have raised these questions today. This bill does have another stop, and I certainly would be glad to address these issues.
With that, Representative Scott renews her motion for House File 456 to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. On to House File 415. And we have 10 minutes for House File 415. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 415 and recommend that it be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention.
Representative Scott, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill just talks about the state extending the limits or the prohibitions on the types of expenditures law enforcement can make using forfeiture proceeds in Section 169A.63, Subdivision 10. Specifically, the state should extend those limits and apply them to law enforcement's expenditures to forfeiture proceeds from all crimes, including those in Section 609. And law enforcement should report how it spends the forfeiture proceeds. This includes reporting reporting the total expenditures for several. There's a six categories in the bill that that would extend to, and there have been some recent developments on this bill. We've worked with the county attorney's office, or county attorney's representatives, and Mr. Graff can delineate what those changes would be.
Mr. McGrath, please present your name for the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Lee McGrath. I am the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 415. Mr. Chairman, members, here in Minnesota, we have the best reporting in the nation. We know more than any other, you know more than any other state legislators in the country, just how often, 20 times a day, seizures are occurring in Minnesota under the various forfeiture laws. These 90% of these seizures are in drugs, we know that, and in DWIs, we know that. This is the major area of forfeiture. But what we don't know, and what this bill provides, what you don't know, is how is the $7 million spent that the legislature has decided to allow law enforcement to keep. You have, if I could be so bold, Mr. Chairman, the state your predecessors have abdicated their responsibility to raise and appropriate all funds. That is the responsibility of legislators. What has happened is that law enforcement, the executive branch, can raise and appropriate its own funds. This bill says, well, we're not going to change that, but at least you should report in six buckets, and we're happy to work that number down with the County Attorneys Association. Six buckets, how that money is being spent. The second thing that this bill does is that it codifies in statute that law enforcement should not engage in the type of problems that we have seen in Minnesota and we see nationally, that law enforcement is seizing for salaries, is pursuing cash instead of contraband so as to supplement their budget. Current law prohibits law enforcement from doing anything other than supplementing their budget. But this is a clear statement that we don't want law enforcement to use forfeiture funds for salaries and benefits and over time. It is a statement of policy that is rooted in the idea that law enforcement should not have a personal incentive. Now, there will be those who can come forward and say, show us the evidence of corruption. And what I would suggest to you is that we have had past evidence, but we also have human nature. And we know that incentives matter. You have tax policy all the time that directs people through incentives. This is a simple prohibition, a clear declarative prohibition, and I'm happy to answer any questions and urge the committee's support of this bill.
Mr. McGrath, we're going to hold questions until the end of the testifiers. Auditor Rebecca Otto in the room? Please come forward and testify. State your name for the record, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I'm here today to an amendment probably needs to be done to the bill, and I can work with Representative Scott or Representative, Lash, whoever they would like. There's some reporting requirements to our office, and we currently collect forfeiture reporting data from law enforcement. And the nature of this data is more financial in nature, and so we are going to recommend moving the reporting requirement into a different section of statute in an amendment so that it lines up with the folks who will be reporting the data to us. So it's really technical in nature. And also an enactment date, local governments are going to have to create some accounting codes to account for specific expenditures with these funds. So they'll need time to do that. They're on a calendar year basis, so it'll be January 1, 16 if this were to go into effect is when you'd want the reporting would be for year end December 31, 16 so that they'll have a full year of data. Timing, if you tie it into these forfeiture statutes, it'll be a long time before you see the data, so we might be able to do something differently again if we can. We're trying to work on keeping it efficient and have some suggested changes. Also, I wanted to make sure people know that this is going to be self-reported data. So sometimes legislators will say, did you audit this? Or people want to know. This isn't going to be auditable for us. There's nothing we can tie it to or compare it to because this level of detail will not show up in an audit. Audited financial statements, but it'll be reported. the capacity of our staff to chase entities to make sure they report. This will be, we don't have a lot of staff to do that, but we will certainly educate on the reporting requirement if it comes through, and remind them they have a reporting requirement. Finally, I want to make sure I got the most important points. Oh, the funding. I guess it's more of a finance committee question, but it'd be extraordinarily difficult for us to charge fees for reporting. We've never done this before, and it would be hard. We don't have the staff capacity to do it. However, we're trying to get an FTE for IT as an office because we're all data-driven now and technology-driven. That if we get that person, we can absorb the cost of this. So that was just one other point I wanted to make. And our amendment we worked on, but we didn't quite get it done into the form we hoped for. But I wanted to make sure we at least maybe work on this behind the scenes.
Thank you, Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is Mr. Robert Small, would he like to testify? Please come forward. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you again. My name is Robert Small, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Thank you for letting me comment on House File 415. This bill has also been reviewed by our criminal and civil law committees as well as our board of directors. And as this bill is written, we oppose it, but we have had several very productive discussions with the proponents of the bill, and we agree that the focus of the legislative changes this year should be focused on improving meaningful and improved reporting. We're open to working towards improving this bill as it moves forward in that process. There's just a couple of key issues that I'd like to highlight and then move on to the next person. Several areas of the bills reiterate how forfeited funds may be used. To the extent they are duplicative, we don't think they are necessary, as the current law exists to designate and restrict the allowable uses under current law, and to that extent that it further restricts, it's duplicative, and we oppose that language. The final section of the bill relating to the reporting requirements could be tightened up and to provide for online reporting requirements that are more reflective of how the funds are actually spent, and I think we have an agreement with the advocates to work on this item, and we'd be happy to do this with the assistance of the author as well. Finally, the last section of the bill that you just heard Auditor Otto, thank you very much, talk about, we're open to discussions in working on some language that will make all that work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Benjamin Feist, please come forward and say.
In light of time, I don't need to testify.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else from the audience that would like to testify in this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you could please keep your remarks brief and please state your name for the record.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Shelley Schofer, Lieutenant Colonel with the Minnesota State Patrol. State Patrol has always had the policy that we forfeit every vehicle meeting the statutory requirements, regardless of whether or not it makes financial sense for the State Patrol to do so. We believe this was the intent of the legislature when the impaired driving vehicle forfeiture law was signed into effect in 1992. We have approximately 8 full-time employees who work as forfeiture coordinators to handle the number of vehicles forfeited by impaired drivers every year. These coordinators handle the documentation and paperwork necessary for successful prosecution. They handle the release of property, towing bills, attorney bills, and other administrative functions directly related to vehicle forfeiture. We contract as well with law firms to provide forfeiture prosecution when necessary, and those fees are also paid with out of our forfeiture funds. Our ability to use the forfeiture funds allows the State Patrol to follow the statutes related to impaired driving vehicle forfeiture with a minimized burden on trunk highway funds. If the bill is signed into law as it stands today, we would be either forced to lay off vehicle forfeiture coordinators or assign their duties to State Patrol troopers, which would result in the decreased number of troopers on our roadways. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, is it the State Patrol's policy that every vehicle that falls within the permissible parameters of forfeiture set by this legislature should, in fact, be forfeited?
It is. We don't make a determination of whether or not the vehicle should or shouldn't, or whether or not it's financially appealing to us or not. We believe that the vehicle is subject to forfeiture under the forfeiture laws, that we seize the vehicle.
Well, Ms. Chair and Colonel, I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said the quickest way to repeal a bad law is to enforce it strictly. I know that the St. Paul City Attorney's Office has stopped doing forfeitures in light of the fact that independent attorneys made independent decisions in certain situations where these forfeitures are certainly called for. And I'm sure you see it as a virtue that the State Patrol does not make determination about whether you're going to forfeit a jalopy, considering it's going to cost you money. But there may be other considerations in there as well. So I just wanted that noted, and I thought it was appropriate that you noted that for the record, that you are taking the laws that we hand you and enforcing them strictly, and I'm not sure that's always what we completely intend here. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel, for your testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Scott.
I just wanted to say that some of her comments, I think, probably apply to the previous bill more so than to this one, or maybe a little bit of both, but just wanted to make that clarification.
Thank you. And in the interest of time, we need to vote on this bill. Representative Scott renews her motion for House File 415 to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The ayes have it. House File 415 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, while we're waiting for the next bill, since I didn't get to say this before, but the reality is that law enforcement agencies don't try to seize the cash, just to operate. The reason we go after the cash is because that's the reason criminal enterprise networks exist, and that contraband is shipped or dealt with, as stated by Mr. I am sorry, I forget your name, in a manner to minimize the loss. But the money is where you get the snake's head.
Thank you for those comments. Next, we're on to House File 337. Representative Sanders, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I would like to move Representative Sanders' bill, House File 337, to be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Go ahead and present your bill, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is the Campaign Finance Board's non-controversial technical bill as of this point, and I think Mr. Guerin can let us know specifically, but I think we're here for a few sections in this bill. I believe there's sections 4, 5, and 10, which deal with increased penalties for failure to file different purposes. Section 19, which deals with the PCR program and if folks are willingly issuing PCR receipts to folks that are not eligible to receive those PCR receipts. And then Section 20 deals with 211B. Mr. Goldsmith is here from the Campaign Finance Board to offer any more expertise into these sections or any others that members have questions on. And I would say we have the board reached out to me over the last couple days, and there is a section in here that we think deals with this committee that we would like to delete. And so I don't know if the committee is amenable to that at this point. I think we have at least one more stop we can deal with it there, but it's Section 7, which deals with board audits and data classification. So it's up to the committee if you want, but the Campaign Finance Board has asked if we could delete that. I certainly am fine with that in this bill. And again, if the committee is willing to take that up, Mr. Goldsmith can help walk us through that as well.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Mr. Goldsmith, could you introduce yourself for the tape and then explain why you were wanting to delete Section 7?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. my name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Last year, the legislature enacted some changes to how we handle investigations and audits and required us to do administrative rulemaking, which we completed on time. During the process of that, we had intended and wanted to do a complete review of the intersection of Chapter 10A and Chapter 13, the Data Practices Act. And because the rulemaking had to be completed by December 31st, we were not able to do that complete review. There are places in Chapter 10A, for example, with regard to investigations, where Chapter 10A says the investigation is confidential. It doesn't say anything more than that. That's the word that's used. And the board applies that. Chapter 10A then goes on to say that until findings have been released, we can't talk about an investigation or even acknowledge its existence. However, we do notify, under the statute, the person who's being investigated. The board takes the position that we are not entitled to and do not have the authority to do John Doe investigations, in other words, to investigate somebody when they don't even know about it. This language in Section 7 was added last year as part of an expansion of the economic interest program, although the language is broader and really applies to all audits. The board didn't actually draft this language, and upon studying it, became concerned about classifying audit data as confidential data as defined in 13.02, because confidential data under 13.02 means data that we cannot even share with the subject of the data. And of course, if we're auditing someone, we want to share it with the subject of the data, and other provisions require us to do that. We thought we could improve the language by the amendment that was proposed, and upon further study, we've concluded, and I spoke with the director of the Information Policy Analysis Division yesterday, and she agrees with me that the proposed amendment actually makes the situation worse rather than better. And so our proposal is to leave the statute as is. We will continue to give notices to people who are being audited and to discuss the audits with them. At the same time, during the interim, we plan to do a complete analysis of the intersection, not only of this provision, but all of Chapter 10A with Chapter 13, so that first of all, we can educate the board as to the issues and the potential conflicts, and then the board can come to some conclusion as to how it will report back to you and whether it will make recommendations, so that once and for all, we understand what confidential means under Chapter 10A and what the rights are of an individual who's being investigated under Chapter 10A versus how that definition might be interpreted differently under Chapter 13. So in other words, Madam Chair and members, the reason for deleting this at this point is to not make matters worse, to maintain the status quo until we have a chance to do a thorough review of the matter.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. I just wanted to ask our counsel here, if in the instance that you gave where it just says confidential, it doesn't say confidential data, is that correct, Mr. Goldsmith?
That's correct, Madam.
Okay. And so could things be made easier for your interpretation by adding the word data? Because that is defined in Chapter 13. I don't know if Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair and Mr. Goldsmith, actually maybe just a clarifying question. Is the intent to delete Section 7 of the bill but retain Subdivision 10 as it exists in current statute, or are you intending to repeal all of Subdivision 10?
Madam Chair, Mr. Gearing, our intent was just to delete the Section 7, not to delete the statute, but to leave the statute in place as it exists now. We've interpreted it a little differently than the technical language would require, because we've interpreted it consistent with the rest of Chapter 10A to require us to notify the subject of an audit that the person is being audited and to share that audit with that person. So I think with our interpretation, we could leave the statute as is and then readdress it. It could be amended to fix it now, but we thought that was more than we wanted to bring before the committee.
Okay. Mr. Goldsmith, would you like to walk through the changes in the bill that apply to this committee?
Certainly, Madam Chair. There are three similar changes, and they're in Sections 4, 5, and 10, so I'll really start with Section 4 and describe that, and then just mention Sections 5 and 10. Section 4 begins on line 23 on page 6. And all three of these changes are to increase late filing fees and civil penalties consistent with what the legislature has been doing over the last two or three years, to move them off that $5 per day late filing fee, to make the late filing fee something that's actually meaningful that might convince a person that they're that filing on time is in their own best interest rather than paying a late filing fee or a civil penalty. And in each case, we remove what's been referred to as a grace period. There's always a period of time in the statute that you have after a triggering event before you have to file the notice. So, for example, in Section 4, this is the lobbyist registration statute. The lobbyist already has 5 days after becoming a lobbyist before they have to file the statement. They were then given another 10 days before a late filing fee was triggered. This would eliminate the 10-day grace period. It would also increase the late filing fee from $5 to $25 a day to a maximum of $1,000 and eliminate a it maintains the certified letter requirement before a further civil penalty could be applied. That same thing happens in two other sections then, Madam Chair, and that's Section 5 and Section 10. Section 5 is the requirement that a public official who represents a person or a company before a state agency or board for a fee file a notice of that representation. And the same thing occurs here is they have 10 days after that representation. I'm sorry, they have 14 days after that representation to file the notice. And the grace period after that 14 days would be eliminated, and the late filing fee would be increased from $5 to $25 per day. And then Section 10 does the same thing in the campaign finance program for registration. So a committee or fund has to register within 14 days after the triggering event of raising a specific amount of money. That's maintained. The additional 10-day grace period is eliminated. And the late filing fee is increased from $5 to $25 per day. I will point out to this committee that there's one more case in Chapter 10A where that $5 per day late filing fee is still retained, and the board specifically looked at it and recommends retaining the lower late filing fee in that case, and that's for the filing of statements of economic interest. And the reason we recommend keeping a low late filing fee is because we're onboarding so many new public officials, all the county commissioners, all the district court judges, and we have hundreds and hundreds of soil and water conservation district people, water management organization people, and many of these people, it's either new or they don't recognize that they're public officials, and so we're working with those, and several years from now we might feel that it's appropriate to raise that one, but not at this point. So those are the late filing fee increases. I'll then turn to Section 19, which is on page 16, beginning at line 3. If you take a look at the actual amendment, which starts at line 16.15, Part B, already in statute, says that the willful issuance of a political refund receipt. This is the receipt that you can file to get $50 or $100 back. It's just like cash once you send it to the Department of Revenue. The willful issuance by a person who did not sign a public subsidy agreement, and then if you skip the new language and get to line 1620, is a misdemeanor. That's current law. It's already a crime. Under current law, that's the only remedy. It's a criminal remedy. There is no ability of the board to impose some lesser remedy in the form of a civil penalty. Secondly, in current law, if a person who did sign a public subsidy agreement starts handing out receipts to people who didn't give that candidate money, or people who, for some other reason, the candidate knew really shouldn't be getting a receipt, that's actually okay. It's not morally okay or ethically okay, but it's not a violation of statute. So as we reviewed this, we proposed adding the corresponding violation, which is at paragraph C on line 16.17, which would prohibit a person who signed an agreement from willfully, that is with knowledge, giving a receipt to somebody who was not entitled to get it. I've heard only anecdotally about that happening and only many years ago, but we still feel that this was an appropriate recommendation to make. And then on line 16.18 and 19, the board is proposing for either of those violations that a civil penalty be provided up to $3,000, which is the maximum civil penalty under most cases that the board can impose for all the other things in Chapter 10A, and so that this would provide a penalty that's less severe than the criminal penalty and one that the board can could impose. And then the last provision, Madam Chair and members, is Section 20, which is actually on the same page at line 16.23. A few years ago, the legislature gave the board jurisdiction over three provisions of Chapter 211B as they relate to candidates who are already under our jurisdiction under 10A, so candidates like yourselves, state candidates, and so on. Those three sections are the prepared and paid for disclaimer section, the use of political money section, and the corporate contribution section. Under Chapter 211B, which is still administered and enforced by the Office of Administrative Hearings for local offices and even against Chapter 10A candidates for most of its provisions, the OAH has the benefit of an overall provision that says it can impose a civil penalty of up to $5,000 for any violation. The board has no general civil penalty authority in Chapter 10A or elsewhere. Every time the board can impose a civil penalty, it has to be in the specific statute where the penalty is provided for. And so when we took over jurisdiction of those three provisions of Chapter 211B, we did not inherit the OAH's $5,000 civil penalty authority. So while we have jurisdiction to enforce those provisions right now, we don't have the ability to do anything from a civil penalty standpoint. So when we find a violation, for example, of the omission of a disclaimer on signs or other material, we can find a violation but not impose any sort of sanction. And so this provision would give the board civil penalty authority of up to $3,000, not five like the OAH has, for those provisions of 211B that we have, over which we have jurisdiction and for which 211B doesn't provide its own specific civil penalty. And that, Madam Chair, completes the civil and criminal penalty sections and data practices sections.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Member questions? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, this doesn't relate to the sections you talked about, but Section 1 is a question I have about that I've wondered for a while. So if we're removing that putting up a lawn sign does not count as a contribution, how does that impact the area that I've never been able to figure out if a business is incorporated or not, so which is illegal if it's a contribution? Is that saying now, is that making a change so that you can put signs all up on business property that was not, that is incorporated, that was prohibited before, or was it not prohibited before and now I'm just misinterpreting that?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, thank you for the opportunity to address that question. This was actually an amendment in the previous committee in this body. This is not technically part of the board's recommendation, but the board can administer the provision, so we take no real position on its merits. But the effect it would have, and it is coupled, by the way, with Section 26, which I think addresses the other part of your question. And the board, I think, actually in general supports this because we get questions all the time about putting up signs. And so what the definition of contribution in section 1, which is the 10A definitions, says that if a sign of, and this is any size, it's not limited to size, if a sign is put up on a person's property that's used as their residence, it's not recognized as a contribution. So that would answer the question for us of what about people putting up signs on a residential property at a great intersection? Well, it's not a contribution. And it also answers the question of what about a farmer who lives on a corporate farm putting up a sign in his or her yard on their corporate farm property? Well, if it's their residence, it's not going to be recognized as a contribution under the definitions of Chapter 10A. Now, to complete the circle of this, because those types of things are also prohibited under Chapter 211B, the corporate contribution prohibition, on page 19 at line I'm sorry, let me find, it's section 27, provides the corresponding right of a corporation. However, this is limited. It's limited to a sign 18 by 24 inches in size. So that's what the printers I contacted says is the standard sort of yard sign. And so it's placing a sign on corporate property that's not residential of not more than 18 by 24 inches would no longer be recognized as a contribution that was prohibited under Section 211B. So the purpose of the two provisions together is to allow people to put signs on their own property without limit, and they would not be recognized as contributions and not reported, and to allow corporations to put signs of up to 18 by 24 inches per candidate, one sign per candidate, as I would understand the bill, and those would not be prohibited and would not be recognized as a contribution.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sanders, so was this an amendment that came out of another committee, the corporate sign placement piece?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, yes.
And Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, whose amendment was that?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lesh. I don't remember. Perhaps Mr. Gehring or Mr. Goldsmith, you remember. It happened in the Government Operations and Elections Committee. I know that the language was, before the amendment, I do know that the language was drafted with the Campaign Finance Board's knowledge and with their help and direction as well. I'm sorry, I don't remember who offered the amendment.
Okay, well,
Mr. Gehring shaking his head, he doesn't remember either, so.
Okay, and that's fine, Madam Chair. And I just wonder about this because I'm surprised that we would expand things in this way. It seems like Minnesota's had a strong tradition of limiting the one person, one vote rule to actual citizen participation and not expanding it to greater influence by virtue of owning a corporation. So I have problems with that language that's included in there. Maybe no one else does, but that's just me, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh, this means that you can actually put an 18 by 24 on somebody's farm in your district.
Well, thank you. And although, Madam Chair, while we have urban agriculture in my district, it's mostly limited to basements with grow lights. So they won't have the signs in the basement. That's their decorating choice.
Very good.
Well, Madam Chair and
Representative Sanders.
And Representative Lesh, this is, you know, from what I understand, this is something that folks have been coming to us, and as Mr. Goldsmith said as well, a tremendous amount of questions. So this is seeking to provide some clarification around the issue and setting up some ground rules. You know, this is designed to be or should be a non-controversial bill. So if there are issues or problems with this language, we certainly can take a look and have the discussion. You know, if there's provisions, I mean, this should be as non-controversial as possible. But this language was, I would say, designed to provide some clarification around this issue because perhaps there's opportunity for discussion on what that clarification can be, but certainly think some is needed from where statute currently sits or doesn't exist on the issue.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Mr. Goldsmith has a question or wants to add something.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh. I just wanted to clarify, I think it's already clear, but I'll say it once more, that the board reviewed this for administrative capacity and we would be able to administer the bill, and we think it does what the author intended it to do. The current position is, of course, not that that signs on corporate property are prohibited. When we're called and asked, we tell the person, and this is consistent with what the OAH has said when they've had these cases, is that the candidate needs to pay the corporation the fair market value of the placement of the sign for the duration of the time it's being placed there. And they have to come up on their own with what the fair market value is, and if they come up with it on a reasonable basis, we'll accept that. Typically, it's going to be probably below the $200 itemization threshold, and we won't see it. What this does is eliminates the need to actually pay the corporation for that, and in that sense, it does expand the right of corporations to participate.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. We have a couple of member questions. Representative Lesch.
I'm sorry. Can I just clarify for purposes
sure.
of Representative Sanders?
Representative Lesch.
So, and Madam Chair, you know, the farming issue, not an issue for me at all. I can totally see how, you know, folks want to put signs along the road. I'm, of course, thinking it through the lens of my district where you drive down the street and you got all these residences with signs, one side or the other. And then there's the gas station that's owned by a holding corporation out of Utah that all of a sudden has all this particular candidate signs on it. Well, and you go in there and, of course, the campaign worker from whatever campaign went in and just asked the person at the desk, the minimum wage clerk, can I put up a sign? And they said, yeah. And then you got to go find out. And there's this big hoo-ha about who gave permission and can they give permission or if that actually is a corporation or if the person holds it. So that's why I get a headache over this language, is making that determination. If this language allows for that now, then I have an issue for it, because we can't make the determination of actually who's making the decision to display that political sign.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Members, I know there's some other questions. This bill does have another stop in state gov finance, so I would suggest that if you have issues, that you contact the bill's author. We do need to get going. We have one more bill to hear, and we have to be out of here on time. So we're going to go ahead and vote on House File 337. Representative Sanders renews his motion to recommend to pass and send to the Committee on State Gov Finance, again, House File 337. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The bill is on its way to State Gov Finance. Thank you, Representative Sanders. The next bill is 446. Representative Mahoney. Welcome to the committee, Representative Mahoney. Would you like Representative Lesch to move House File 446 and recommend that it be referred to the Committee on Taxes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Representative Mahoney, go ahead and present your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a committee with a lot of lawyers on it, so I will talk in small sentences and monosyllables. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 446 is a fix, not really a big fix, to something that's been going on for a while. In today's family law, there's really no direction for the judges to award the child income tax credit to a parent with less parenting time than the other. They have figured out a workaround. Workarounds are great. We do that all the time around here. What this bill does is put into language what the judges would have to do, what the judges would have to follow in order to do that. Subsection 7 defines what it is, allowing the income tax dependency exemption for a child to be given to another parent. Line 1.13 that states that the court shall consider the following. The rest of the bill kind of lays that out, and I'll just go through it without giving lines. It asks the court to look at the financial resources of each party, make sure that the dependency exemption does not negatively impact a parent's ability to provide for the need of a child. If one party or both parties receive a tax benefit, that the impact of the dependent exemption does not affect a parent's ability under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act of 2010. The court may place reasonable conditions on the party's right to claim an exemption. It does say that if a party has less than 10% of court-ordered parenting time, they have to have agreements by both parties. The court may issue an order to modify a prior allotment of the income tax dependency exemption.
and if an allotment of an exemption is contested, the court may make findings supporting its decision on the allotment. Then, starting on page 2, line 11, it defines what the court can do if one participant falsely claims the dependent exemption and what the remedies are. And those remedies are they can require them to pay restitution or compensation and to pay for any reasonable costs and fees to the party making the motion. It also states that the motion must be brought within 3 years of the of the violation.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Does anyone in the audience wish to testify on this bill? Ms. Hugdahl, go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. We've been working with Representative Mahoney in the dialogue process on this bill and support it and would encourage members' support. Within the legal community, I've been getting quite a bit of feedback from my own folks and in general that there is much rejoicing to have some pieces of case law finally into the statute. And I think the enforcement piece was something that was really important to folks, that if a parent is not following the court order to sign the disclosure form under federal law, they have some form of relief in state court. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hugdahl. Questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Lesh renews his motion to, let me get my script here, to refer House File 446 to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The bill passes to the Committee on Taxes. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. With that, the meeting is adjourned.